The Pat Kenny Show
with Timber Living Log Cabins.
Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.
Now, if you are venturing into the capital today, be prepared for a colourful experience, because just after we go off air, a rainbow of colour will be unleashed on the capital's streets as the contribution of Ireland's LGBTQ plus community is celebrated. But 11 years since Ireland's historic marriage equality referendum, just how far have we moved the dial when it comes to discrimination and marginalisation of the LGBT community? Well, I'm delighted to be joined in studio by LGBTQ activist James O'Hagan and Tony Walsh, founding editor of Gay Community News. Good morning and welcome.
Hello, Pat. Much great to be here.
I haven't seen you for a long time, Indeed. Tony. You are now living in other parts of the world.
Exactly.
So when you come back to Dublin, how different is it to what we call the bad old days?
It's extraordinarily vital, in a word. That's what it is. It is exuberant, as you said. It's colourful. It's wonderful. I see people living their lives without fear and shame that attach to it. When I remember coming out in the late 70s and early 80s,
well, and it was not an easy thing to do.
No, it wasn't. And also, too, we have to contextualise that pride grew out of endemic poverty, the AIDS pandemic. There was a lot of other things happening in Ireland that actually impacted the Troubles in the North. All of these sociocultural and political elements impacted on the way LGBT people had to struggle to find their collective voice. And also, too, we have to remember that David Norris was still progressing his constitutional action. Sex between men was illegal.
I mean, this goes back to the 1861 Offences Against the Persons Act, which remained in place until ultimately on foot of David Norris's efforts in Europe.
Indeed, until 1993, and also too, until those laws were abolished, it was impossible to advance anti-discrimination and equality legislation. And of course, James here has been very involved in that process. We couldn't have had things like marriage equality or the Equal Status Act or the Gender Recognition Act until we'd got decriminalisation out of the way in 1993.
Now, the first Pride Festival was actually more than 40 years ago.
Indeed, it was where two women and eight guys did a protest outside the British Embassy and the Department of Justice, protesting those very British laws that you referenced from the 19th century. And if you jump forward a little while later, it was only with the establishment of community spaces like the Hirschfeld Centre in Temple Bar that provided the economic and human resources to progress an actual Pride festival. And you know what? The first festivals, I mean, I remember going on my first festival in 1980. There were only 16 of us wandering around town, and I was brazen as hell, a 19-year-old, you know, just up for a little bit of crack, not really appreciating the dangers that lurked around the corner. We just gave out flyers. There weren't enough people for a parade. All of that would actually happen much later on. And it's actually what's really lovely now is, you know, you look at 52 years of LGBT civil rights on the island of Ireland. We're still progressing that journey.
Yeah. Now, the Pride event today will be enormous. There'll be thousands of people there and thousands more not participating but watching and enjoying the spectacle. But some of the early Pride festivals, I mean, a picnic in Merrion Square.
A picnic in Merrion Square, it sounds very middle class, actually. A few bottles of wine in the Sunday Times or whatever. Gorgeous. But, I mean, you know, those sort of sociocultural events were hugely important.
And yet you were moved on.
We were indeed. You know your history really well, Pat. Yeah. We were actually moved on. But, you know, there's a gorgeous symmetry to actually the Dublin Pride Festival now being back in Merrion Square. I mean, that's the end point of the parade, where there'll be upwards of 100,000 people actually in a very family-centric environment marking today. So we really literally have come full circle.
Now, it was against the law to come out and admit that you were a homosexual in those days. But how oppressive was it? Because I think even I remember my father referring to one of his friends as he didn't have the word gay, because that's a relatively modern phenomenon, given that my father would be well over 100 were he alive, be alive today. But he knew that, you know, he had a friend or two, and there was no overt discrimination. They just lived and let live.
Well, they were very lucky, but I think oppression plays out, and repression plays out, and can play out in very insidious, invisible, intangible ways. You know, when we look back in that period, and we look at back at Ireland before decriminalisation, and by the way, it's lovely that this very week the government is progressing the disregard bill to actually expunge those criminal convictions. Mm-hmm. But when you look back on that, it's not just about the crude numbers of men who, gay and bisexual men, who are sent to prison for nothing more than loving another man or having sex with another man. It's the intangible corrosive impact of the law and how that played out. And I think what I'm referring to now is the culture of self-censorship that exists. Mm. The fact that, and you would have been aware of it as a broadcaster and a journalist, how the media was reluctant to take up positive images and explore positive images. I mean, the Evening Herald was still using the word gay in inverted commas up until 1989.
Mm. You know, but I'm thinking, believe. Even as a young broadcaster going to interview Hilton Edwards and Michael McLean more in their home in Harker Terrace. And everybody knew this was Ireland's most obvious out gay couple. But there was never any attempt to prosecute them or...
Well, they had a privilege of wealth and status and the theatre. You know, so you didn't touch people who were working in the theatre. It's no coincidence that lots of lesbians and gay men actually found refuge in entertainment and the arts because they were a little bit more liberal. But, you know, there was repression actually did impact on people. We've no way of quantifying it, but anecdotally, we know of thousands of lesbians and gay men who left Ireland right throughout the 20th century in search of more socially liberal.
But you're saying that if people were in those professions, there was a tolerance of people in the colourful professions.
Indeed, and a certain omerta of silence where people just didn't talk about it outside of those circles that so-and-so was gay. You know, somebody like a broadcaster and one of your former colleagues, Vincent Hanley. I mean, it would have been known. Vincent's sexuality would have been known in limited circles, but outside of that, nobody would have talked about it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether the kind of gay bashing that became... I suppose, characteristic of the latter part of the 20th century, whether that emerged as a result of people, quote-unquote, ordinary people coming out.
That's a really astute observation. And actually, when you look, we wouldn't have known it at the time, but when you look back at that period, particularly the late 70s and 80s, you do see this parabola, a pushback against the increased visibility of the... A newly enabled LGBT community. I mean, there was a raft of just horrible murders right throughout across the island of Ireland throughout the 1980s. And a lot of that came in response to the emergence of pride festivals, people actually appearing more.
In other words, the idea of gays getting uppity.
Indeed, you know, and they needed to be put back in their box.
Yeah, and that was the point I was trying to make, that for many people, as long as they were in the box, that was fine.
Sure.
Yeah. James, you grew up in a different era entirely.
Well, yeah, I mean, I grew up, I was born in 1982, so the first 11 years of my life, I obviously wasn't thinking about or considering my sexual orientation. But looking back now, I suppose I can understand that, you know, I sort of was lucky enough to come out after decriminalisation, and I was still in that sort of era of sort of tolerance, you know, whenever people were, we're tolerant of. We hadn't moved quite to the language used now around inclusion and belonging. So, you know, when I was coming out to my parents when I was around sort of 16 or 17, there was a real sense of like, we love you, you can be who you are, but let's just keep this a bit quiet. Like, let's not quite, like, let's be careful who we tell. And it wasn't coming from a place of shame around my identity, but it was coming from a place of wanting to make sure that I was protected and I was safe. And I think it's exactly because of having lived through, for my parents, having lived through that period of time where they had seen the violence and some of the attitudes that existed towards members of our community, that there was a fear of what sort of life was I going to have. And to be honest, I couldn't have answered that question myself at the time. I think it came out the same year that Queer as Folk, that sort of, you know, seminal TV show was on Channel 4, and that was the first time I'd ever seen representation of people in a community that I could actually belong to. And sort of, and I think that you know, that visibility point is so important.
So you've matured through the age of marriage equality and all of that, but I'm wondering, do you discern, because of what's happening internationally, this is a conservatism growing up, you know, gays in the military in the United States being, I suppose, prejudice being shown towards them. Are you seeing any of that kind of thing here?
I think that it's insidious, and it gets in a way that you were talking about the sort of intangibility, or you were sort of mentioning that the intangibility of these things, and it gets in under your skin. And I think certainly, like, I look back to, say, 2015 and that period immediately after marriage equality, and there was this real sense of you could walk with your head held up high and your shoulders and your back, and you felt so confident that you could take the hand of your partner in public, or if you were in a non-queer space, that, you know, you could give your partner like a kiss on the cheek, or you could be, you know, boisterous in your identity. And certainly in the last 11 years, that has felt like it has ebbed away. And sort of, you know, anecdotally,
would you hesitate holding?
I would. Yeah, I think that I have definitely noticed the sense of feeling sort of less comfortable to be sort of demonstrative, or even less comfortable to kind of, you know. If I'm it goes back to the speech that Panty made at the Abbey in 2014, mm-hmm. that sort of checking yourself, that feeling of kind of sort of looking around the room and thinking, well, is there going to be someone here that sort of is going to take issue with my identity? And I think we've seen sort of those attitudes become emboldened because there is more of a support growing for it. And you're seeing what's happening around the world, and it feels, you know, like you have to second guess yourself.
Which is, seems like going backwards slightly. Now, it has to be said, Ireland is still a very, relatively speaking, safe place.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's a really important point to make, because Ireland is an incredibly safe place to be a member of our community. There are obviously ways in which we can do better, and there are minority groups within our community who maybe are still sort of, you know, still need to sort of go on a bit more of that journey, and sort of we need to kind of find a way to make sure they're more included and have what they need in order to be able to flourish. But I think that globally, the sort of LGBT community has been sort of taken up a little bit as kind of one of the ways in which some of the more far right mm-hmm. actors are kind of creating that misinformation and fear and anxiety about kind of changing worlds. And that is having a blowback then on sort of the safety that people perceive themselves to have, even though we're living in a very safe society.
Now, Tony, you live in Turkey, and I'm, you know, my impression of Turkey under Erdogan would be that it's quite a conservative place. So, How is it for you in that environment?
It is conservative. I mean, Turkey, like Ireland 20 years ago, was just a country of paradoxes. Alcohol is legal from 6 o'clock in the morning. There's no alcohol-fueled bad behaviour on the streets. People are quite civil. But right now we've got an ultra-Islamist party run by Erdogan, propped up by an ultra-nationalist party, who have branded LGBT people terrorists and are using us as a form of political collateral to advance a very specific agenda around family rights and around identity. He's
do you
part
have to
of it.
Live carefully, shall we say?
I do, but I'm living in Antalya, city the size of Dublin, and we do have gay clubs. But I do live carefully.
Antalya is also a big holiday destination.
Indeed. So. Yes. And I do. The very fact that it is a holiday destination, 20% of the population is foreign, I think, leavens the vibe in the city. I want to quickly make some remark following what James said, that I think when we're looking at the rise of anti-immigrant rhetoric and anti-queer rhetoric and everything in Ireland, and the way it's been amplified by bad faith actors, it behoves us to remember the core of collective compassion and empathy that I think is at the centre of Irish society, something that we really felt during processes like the marriage equality campaign. And we really need to look to, when we're in moments of trouble, we need to remind ourselves that Irish people generally, the majority of Irish people are not like that. Yeah. And I really don't believe that Irish people, the majority of Irish people, are fundamentally homophobic. And even some of the people, the yabos, who are coming out with anti-homophobic rhetoric and nastiness, a lot of the time what they're doing, they're just using us as an easy fall guy for a whole set of problems that they have. We're just easy pickings.
Okay. Now, how important is a Pride event like today? Today's March, there'll be one in Limerick over the weekend, and one in Cork probably as well. So, how important are they? Are they still necessary?
They really are. And I think that you know, even if we achieve full inclusion, full equality, we're absolutely embedded in society, I think it'll still be important that there's a space for us to go out and sort of, you know, really visibly celebrate our identities. Because I think it's important for difference to be celebrated and for people from all different walks of life to have a moment to be able to sort of really speak about their identity with pride. But I think that the likes of Dublin and Cork, Belfast Pride, those big events are really great for getting people to be able to come together. But what's so important is to see these Pride festivals now taking place in small towns and rural communities right across the country, because that's new. That's not something that's been happening for very long.
Pride's also asking another big question. It's not just about allowing us to have a fabulous day out. I mean, that's really important, you know. But it is also asking, and I'm reminded of early Pride, where we had a big banner that said, gay liberation is your liberation. Pride is also an invitation to people to come on the journey, to everyone else to come on the journey and beg the question, what type of society are we creating amongst all of us?
Well, if you're coming into the city today, the capital city, the march will start at 12 and will weave its way down O'Connell Street and all the way over to Merrion Square, scene of that famous picnic. All right. Look, James O'Hagan, LGBT activist, and Tony Walsh, founding editor of Gay Community News and himself an LGBT activist. Thank you both very much for joining us in studio.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Timber Living Log Cabins.